amateur preacher Jerry Pritikin, jazz trumpeter Nicholas Payton, and another installment of Never Have I Ever. And now, here's your host, a man who has the best idea to stop texting and driving, Justin Kaufman.
It's good. Get rid of automatics. All shift. Stick shift. Right? If we went back to that, if you didn't have automatics anymore and you had to have one hand on the gear shifter, how can you text? I mean, it's kind of brilliant. Think about it. I just saved society. Thank you. Right? I mean, how can you, if you had to constantly have your right hand on the shifter and you were going second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, eighth, 15th, whatever it is nowadays, and you did not have the ability to not pay attention to that, you would never pick up your phone.
What I would do in that situation, I would use my knee on the steering wheel, text with my left hand.
So I would have
shift with my right.
Accidentally made it more dangerous. Just like that, right? Every time I try to help out society, I make it worse. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here in beautiful Chicago tonight. What a day. The Riverwalk is open. Downtown Chicago, Michigan Avenue is bustling. We have a tremendous show lined up for you tonight, whether you're downtown, whether you're driving home, maybe you're already home, you're getting ready for dinner, maybe you finished dinner, you're going to drink a cold one on the porch. Whatever you got going on tonight, we got you riding shotgun here on 720 WGN. As always, tonight, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Grand Bargain and some of the things that are popping out of the Grand Bargain that are a little bit concerning to some people, including a home repair tax. This is an interesting story as we talk about what's it going to take to balance the budget, bring in new revenues. Well, you know, the Grand Bargain includes some things in there that we haven't been talking about in the media. One is a home repair tax, Pete. So if you decide that you want to redo your kitchen, the state wants some of that money. And that's something that the Home Builders Association of Illinois is saying, hold on right there. We're not going to punish and hurt people in the city of Chicago or the state of Illinois that want to do something with their house. But these are some of the things that are coming out of the Grand Bargain and a balanced budget that we're in such need to get a balanced budget that we're not looking at what is actually inside of it. So here on the download, we want to kind of break it down and take a look at some of the things that are coming out. Tonight, we'll talk about the home repair tax that has been proposed in Springfield. Coming up at 8 o'clock, I'm very excited to have trumpet virtuoso, Grammy Award-winning musician Nicholas Payton in studio. He's going to be at the Symphony Center this week, tomorrow night, with his new album, his mixtape, Afro-Caribbean mixtape. But Nicholas Payton is a tremendous, tremendous trumpet player and one of the young Turks of jazz. There was a time when Nicholas Payton was mentioned as one of the saviors of that art form. A young trumpet player that came up and New Orleans trumpet player. He's sort of in the same package as the Marsalis's, Verve Records. Anyway. Blue Note, like just a tremendous, tremendous jazz talent, started at a very, very, very young age. I think he started touring at 12 years old, and he comes from a jazz family. So we'll talk to him about his illustrious career, his Grammy Award-winning career, and now at the age of, I think he's 43 years old now. You think about that, you know, like for a kid who started when he's 12 years old, I'm sure he's got some insights on music and being a musician. And an artist. We'll talk to him coming up at 8 o'clock. Tonight, Jerry Pritikin comes in studio at 9 o'clock. We're going to talk about Jackie Robinson and his visit to Wrigley Field back in May 18th, 1947. That was 70 years ago today. Jackie Robinson and the Brooklyn Dodgers came to Wrigley Field, and it was the highest attendance in the history of Wrigley Field, and it still stands today, regular season. I believe some of the playoff games, even the Wrigley, the World Series last year might have beat it. But the point being that Chicagoans wanted to see the first African-American baseball player, and they came out in droves, not only to the stands, but all around Wrigley Field. I think they said something like 20,000 were out on the streets around Wrigley Field for that day game. There were no lights, 1947. So one fellow that was there was Jerry Pritikin, the bleacher preacher, a famed character at Wrigley Field for years, for decades. He's going to come in studio and talk about his recollections of that famed and historic record-breaking game. May 18th, 1947. And then tonight as well, let's play Never Have I Ever. As I've always said, I never have gone golfing. I know, I say it every time, and it continues to sound more and more absurd as life goes on. Never have I ever seen the movie Citizen Kane. Never have I ever, and I mean this, never have I ever heard a full Toby Keith album. Because I know that, you know, we were talking about Toby Keith in the last segment. Rokan was as well with Anna. I don't know much about his music. I know a lot about his politics because it sort of became articles, but it really never, the marketing didn't work on a young guy from Chicago who was like, you know, I don't know what that was. And after 2001, writing patriotic songs, but I never jumped on the Toby Keith bandwagon. That doesn't mean I didn't jump on the anti-Toby Keith bandwagon. I just missed it. So I would never have I ever listened to a full Toby Keith song. Yeah. They told me it's Red Solo Cups. It was a song, but you lost me at Red. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kopp, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, so Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Hey, who wants to carry out? Here are today's top stories. President Trump said that a special investigator in the probe into his Russian baggage is, quote, dividing the country. Yeah, before this story, we were all holding hands singing Kumbaya. It's definitely dividing some of the country, Republicans. I don't know if too many Democrats are like, man, Trump's great. Oh, he did what now with Russia? Oh, I might have to rethink my loyalty to the Donald. When asked today in a press conference whether he told Comey to back off of Flynn's investigation, Trump said, no, next question. Wait, I don't trust any answer from Trump that doesn't include how unfair this all is and how many electoral votes he got, right? If he doesn't try to brag all time, it's a tell, right? He's hiding something. I think we figured it out. We're figuring out the Trumpster. Anyway, now the rhetoric has taken us from investigation to criminal investigation. You're on double secret probation. Great. It's rumored that President Trump is considering Joe Lieberman for FBI director. Really? That dude from the 2000 election who famously switched parties? Yeah, really draining the swamp on that one. But at this point, maybe the swamp's not a swamp. Maybe it's quicksand. Oh, did I just blow your mind? You can use it. Put it on a calendar. Locally, Alderman Amaya Paywar just put up a resolution in council showing support for the impeachment of President Trump. Whew. I was worried that Chicago City Council thought. I really want to know what they thought about this. You know, I was last night I woke up right in the rainstorm, and I was like, I wonder if they have a thought on what's happening in D.C. And now we have clarity. This country can move forward. The aldermen have spoken. The resolution should begin, since nobody asked us. Hey, the city council did relax zoning to pave the way for the redevelopment of the North Branch of the Chicago River. Another big industrial company cashed out, selling their land to developer Sterling Bay. If you're keeping score, they also own the land for Finkel & Son Steel and the tannery up the street on Elson. They've invested hundreds of millions of dollars on land adjacent to or near the river. Crane said that they bought the land on a hunch, just a gut feeling that the city might lack zoning and redevelop it. Really? Hundreds of million dollars on a hunch? No. Hunches are for $10 bets on roulette. I'm going to hunch. This one's going to go red. For zoning redevelopment, it's not, I have a hunch, but I don't think it's I have a hunch. I think it's more I've got a guy, right? I got a guy. Since we're talking rivers, the Chicago Riverwalk opened up tonight along the river downtown. So if you're interested in getting really close to a river that used to be set on fire, but now features specials on Amstel lights and chips and guac, hey, right around the corner here. A man in Texas sued his date for texting. She was texting during the movie. She went outside, never came back, and he submitted a lawsuit to redeem the ticket price. First off, I just want to say, if you take a date to the 11 a.m., it's a lot cheaper, right? Second off, somebody tells me, I think we now know why you're single, right? Good on him for calling out the texting. But a little advice, texting on the date, that's the effect. What's the cause? The cause is you suck. Possible. Chris Cornell and Roger Ailes died today on the same day. One will spend his days in heaven listening to Soundgarden. The other listening to tapes of Bill O'Reilly's sexy phone calls. What? I said they both are going to heaven. Condé Nast named Chicago the best restaurant city in the country. We beat New York. We beat L.A. We beat Nashville. We beat St. Louis. Should I keep going? Just write down a list of all the... We beat Omaha. Let's hope this doesn't go to our head, though. Hopefully this distinction doesn't give restaurants the power to make plates smaller. Also, you know that the low-end restaurants are going to start getting in the game? We do small plates hamburgers with small plate fries. We also recommend that you get 12 orders. Would you like a Frosty with that? And while we're at it, yes, we have dined at your restaurant before, okay? It's not rocket science. In weather? Wow, this day, huh? Like Miami Beach without the thongs. Real nice. Wait, can we talk about last night? Severe weather, wind and hail? Jekyll and Hyde. It's crazy. And then you wake up today, you're like, what? Was that a dream? In sports, the Cubs did what they were supposed to do, put the Reds in their place. Their fourth place. A nice little sweep at Wrigley to start the homestand. The Cubs gained ground on the Cardinals, but not really on the Brew Crew, who are now all alone at the top of the division. What? Which means a good weekend series at Wrigley. Huh. There you go. At least with the Cubs starting off slow, the baseball gets more exciting as we plow through the season. I mean, I guess it's better than like them starting off 28-8 and being 8 games up, right? Now every weekend's exciting. The White Sox also did what we thought they'd do. They lost 3 in a row to the Angels. Their bullpen used to be the strength, and now they're leaking engine fluid. Injuries have stocked up, and now they can't seem to stay in games. They got to figure it all out quick. They hightail it to Seattle tonight for a 4-game set. They're falling out of this thing. Well, that was quick. All that ink spilled over who got the number one seed in the NBA Eastern Conference. In one game, LeBron took it back. Cavs beat the Celtics 117-104 last night. So in retrospect, I want my clicks back, my page views, right? So, like ESPN's getting that page view from, oh, the Celtics are the number one seed. Now they're not. Get out. No, I want it back. Just imagine, Boston fans, you could have Jimmy Butler and Green next year making this series much more interesting. We just want the number one overall and that goofy white dude with the long hair. I don't know his name. And Isaiah Thomas. He's too short. He's too short for the league. You got to trade him. In the Stanley Cup playoffs tonight, we'll go a long way on whether or not the Nashville Predators are going to the finals. They got a 2-1 lead. They're at home tonight. A win could put the Predators on the brink of their first trip to the ship. Ugh. Predators. And finally tonight, a new study says that if you stop exercising for 2 weeks, your health risks reemerge. So heart attacks, diabetes, muscle atrophy. See, this is another reason to never exercise. I told you from the get-go, exercise was a scam. Once you start, they never let you finish. Trump's right. Huge waste of time. Besides, you get used to the pain in your left arm and the lack of circulation in your feet. It's all in your mind. That's the carryout for May 18, 2017. Hey, we got a ton of soy sauce packets. We threw some in with your pizza. Live a little. All right, coming up here, we'll talk to Home Repair Tax in Springfield. Also, jazz trumpeter Nicholas Payton will be in studio. And the bleacher preacher, Jerry Pritikin. It's the download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Wow. Was it raining last night or what?
Yeah, right.
Deluge.
I was amazed today that we weren't underwater.
Yeah, that was a lot of rain.
It was, and my son had field days today at the school, and I went and helped out. I volunteered sort of station by station, mm-hmm. and I thought, there's no way. It was out in the park, you know. I thought, no way. It's just going to be a mud bath. You couldn't even tell it rained. It's like, I don't know, maybe it was because it was hail or something. It's just there was not muddy at all.
I was hoping that little kid, I think, from the Toyota Prius commercial with his bucket and soap and sponge waiting for it to rain would be out by my car doing my tires last night. Remember that commercial?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. The parents were so proud because he was green. He was waiting for the rain to come so he didn't have to use any water.
Right.
But no, it was pretty heavy.
Yeah,
didn't last long, though. I got about halfway up the Kennedy, and then it was done.
Well, there you go. Soundgarden for you there. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Coming up at 8 o'clock, trumpet virtuoso, multi-instrumentalist Nicholas Payton, Grammy Award winner. We'll talk about his new album, double album, Afro-Caribbean Mixtape. He's in town for the Chicago Symphony Center show tomorrow night, right here on Michigan Avenue. As Springfield continues to work towards a budget and that elusive grand bargain, we're starting to understand more and more about what's in said bargain. The political strategy notwithstanding, there are some new taxes and fees for that both parties are looking at to help find new areas of revenue. We heard a lot about the income tax increase and, of course, a property tax freeze. But there are another new ideas for taxes that aren't sitting well with some groups. Take, for instance, the proposed home repair tax. This would be a tax on home remodeling or repair projects. So you would be taxed if you wanted to renovate or keep your home in good shape. This, again, is not sitting well with the Home Builders Association of Illinois. Joining me on the line, Bill Ward. He's the vice president of the Home Builders Association of Illinois to talk home repair taxes and home building in Chicago and what to be aware of when looking to renovate your home. Mr. Ward, thanks for joining us on Download. We appreciate it.
Hey, Justin. How are you doing?
Good, good. So talk about this home repair tax, because do I have it right in the sense that, you know, with the grand bargain and everything that's been going through the Senate, even breaking it apart and passing things again, there are a lot of new taxes, new ideas for revenue that a lot of consumers in the state of Illinois just aren't paying attention to?
It's not that they're not paying attention to it. It's just that it's hard getting this information out. You're talking about Senate Bill 9 being a 500-page omnibus taxation bill. And so to go through that and understand everything that's going on with taxation in Illinois is quite difficult, and you wouldn't expect the average taxpayer to be able to do that. And the media really has had a hard time wrapping their arms around it, too. So on page 213 of this bill is a tax, service tax, on what is home repair tax. What it says is a service tax on personal property or personal property attached to real estate. So, and then you get into a bunch of things that they can tax or not tax. So it's a very complicated tax and hard to understand for my guys and for consumers.
Are you concerned that that the state government would be looking in the direction of home repair, home renovation for extra tax opportunities? Just because that seems a little bit unorthodox in the way that you would tax people to redo their kitchen or to redo, you know, a porch, things of that nature.
Right. You know, doing repair work on your home is the kind of thing that you want you to do, your neighbors to do, your community to do, and it makes your community stronger. And to tax that would impair that. There's so much concern for that. City of Springfield passed a resolution opposing this portion of Senate Bill 9, saying this is going to be detrimental to certain parts of their city that they're very concerned about, that specifically with senior citizens and with folks with limited incomes, and this is going to be a hardship for them.
Well, it also begs the question. I mean, when you go into this area, you know, and as part of the Home Builders Association of Illinois, I think of other associations around the country. How often does the government get this deep into taxing things that we just take for granted, that every homeowner does at one point or another in the life of their home?
You know, they're looking. Illinois is looking everywhere to take care of an $8 to $13 billion budget hole. That, you know, and a pension situation that is beyond compare. So, I can't imagine that they wouldn't look at things like this in order to try and work this out. But from our perspective, if you look at it from a home remodeler, home repairman perspective, they're going to have a situation where they've got a tax that's very hard to understand. They're going to raise their prices by 6.25% and not get a dime of it. And then I think they believe. I think they're also going to have to pay $75 a year to the Department of Revenue, which will increase the number of auditors that they have, which will increase the number of audits that will be done on these guys. And it just, from their perspective, it seems quite evil.
Yeah, you're right. Bill Ward is the vice president of the Home Builders Association of Illinois. You know, it's such an interesting area because there are so many. We've had this conversation just about development as we just look right here in Chicago, not just, you know, a couple miles in radius of where we're at right now on Michigan Avenue. They're building condo buildings and new housing everywhere. I mean, there are cranes within my purview. I mean, you could see it at every corner in the city of Chicago. Is, you know, where are we at with home building? I mean, when you think about the idea of all these buildings coming up because the economy is strong, from the Home Builders Association, of course, that's a good thing. But what do we have to watch out for so that corners aren't cut, that bad buildings are built, things of that nature?
Well, I first of all, it's hard. I think a lot of what you're seeing going up it must be rental, because the numbers I'm getting from the National Association of Home Builders is that Illinois is 50th in the country in new home construction, building permits to state population ratio. And so I don't think the economic surge is there for home construction that may be perceived living in downtown Chicago. Once you get out into the suburbs and get downstate, we're definitely flatlining. And it's been something that has been flatlining for the past 5 years.
What do you do about that? I mean, as the economy may favor certain areas, or it might go into rentals as opposed to home, you know, to actual building homes. What at the association can you do to put the onus on the government? I mean, obviously they're talking about a home repair tax, so they're not listening. But what can you do to sort of get home building back in style, if you will?
You know, Justin, a lot of legislators ask that question, what makes Illinois different from other states where home construction is rising? And the answer is this, what drives home construction in any state is consumer confidence. And that's just the belief that you're going to sustain an income and your income is going to increase over years. So you have the confidence of purchasing a new home. That's not there in Illinois right now, and it's upon all of us to come together and try to figure out how we create consumer confidence in the state of Illinois, because it's not there. It's in Indiana and other neighboring states, but it's not here.
It's a fascinating part of our economy because you think about the trickle-down. If people are building new homes and buying new homes and putting money back into the economy that way, and it's a sound investment. It just feels like it's part of the cycle that has worked and as part of our economy in the past. At some point or another, does the economy have to shift in the way that maybe people are not going to go back to, you know, buying new homes like the way they did in the past?
It could be. I mean, what drives home construction is new home construction follows manufacturing and new job growth in areas. We follow that, and then we build homes, and then the retail follows us. And that's been going on. That model of community growth has been going on for over 100 years. If that's changing, then that is a dramatic thing that we really need to take a look at. And this could be a change in this whole industry. This economic sector is going to change. And it really is concerning.
Bill, before I let you go, you know, as we get to the last 2 weeks of the session down in Springfield, and there has been talk about, you know, there's more and more frenzy to be able to get to a balanced budget, but at the same time to pass the things that they need to do for this year's budget. Are you concerned that this will get through without any say, or do you feel confident that the legislators are listening to the people when it comes to the home repair tax?
You know, I feel as though this is going to this has got traction in the Illinois State Senate. This was part of the grand bargain. It's a bipartisan promotion, and so the Senate to some degree, has got their arms around this. But I don't get that sense in the Illinois House that they've necessarily signed off on service taxation, and especially on the home repair tax and some of the other service sectors. So I think it's a long way to go before it gets to the governor's desk.
Yeah. We'll be paying attention to service taxation and what comes out of Springfield in the next 2 weeks. Bill Ward is the vice president of the Home Builders Association of Illinois. He joined me tonight to talk to us about some of the things that are happening in Grand Bargain we're not paying attention to. Bill, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Justin, thank you.
Did you hear what Bill Ward said there, Pete? He said that there's a bill. I mean, the bill specifically that they're talking about is, what, 500 pages? And he specifically, at the beginning of that interview, said, on page 213, they say, 500 pages. That's tough, man. And I have a sneaky feeling that when this is all said and done, when the state of Illinois actually does balance a budget, pass a budget, and it gets through, there are going to be a lot of these little page 213s that we didn't know about. And so the debate, the political debate, has been all about ideology. But to balance a budget, especially if you're not going to raise taxes, especially if you're not going to cut services, it has to come somewhere. And so the next time that you go ahead and remodel your kitchen, decide to go with the granite, I'm done with the quartz. I'm going to go with the granite. I'm going to put a backsplash up. And then you deal with the construction and the contractor, and they're like, oh, yeah, there's another. It's only 2% off of the $4,000 that you put in. And you're like, so it's another, you know, it's going to be another couple $100 for you.
Yeah, I don't like that. As someone who has an old place, who needs to do a kitchen and a bathroom and a... That's when I get a YouTube how to repair kitchen.
Well, it's got to hurt. I think that will, at the end of the day, hurt consumers, and it also hurt contractors. And I think it'll hurt a lot of service industry or people who will come in and do odd jobs. Like I, for instance, and I talked about it on the show, I had a frozen pipe burst.
Yeah.
Right? Now I'll have the plumber come out, and in a service taxation, that's what Bill's talking about. I'm sure there's going to be a tax on the plumber as well. But, you know, to cut the wall, I had to get a drywaller, a guy to come out, and
sure,
a contractor I've worked with before. He comes out and he patches it up. Now, I've had a couple people in my house that said, you could probably do that. I'm like, I don't even know where to start.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that I'm that inept, but I could probably figure it out if I wanted to. But I'm also like, well, I don't really want to mess this up, blah, blah, blah. Service tax, I'm like, give me the spackle.
Exactly.
I'm going to figure it out.
Figure it out.
And so the contractor at the end of the day is going to lose the money.
Yep.
Because as a consumer, I'll do everything I possibly can to avoid that tax.
And then when, you know, you want to sell your place and somebody looks at it and says, what's up with this wonky bathroom? It looks like somebody with no carpentry experience right. Put it together.
And I'll be like, no, it's artistic. It's a new style. It's an architecture style. It's called flimsy. I think it's French. It's flimsy.
Yeah.
I remember when I was in college, we had an apartment in Roscoe Village, and we had three bedroom. And one of my roommate's girlfriends at the time was really into remodeling. And she's like, you know what we need to do is remodel this bathroom. And we're like, what? Mm-hmm. Does the water work? There's three 20-year-old guys living
here.
Yeah. And she comes in like, you know, I'm going to do it. I got a basin sink, you know, some cool stuff. It took a week for her to get like ADD and be gone. And so now we had this sink that wasn't actually attached to the, you know what I mean? And like a toilet that just, I'm like, what is this? It's like, you can't just tape it to the wall. And so for the remainder of that time, I had a flimsy bathroom. So that's going to happen. That's what's going to happen with the service taxation that they're talking about. So it'd be interesting, though. We should get a hold of this bill, 500 pages, and we should do a segment on every page. I mean, 500 segments, but maybe we cut out some of the the management speak.
Yeah, well, that's probably 98% of it.
Yeah, so we got two segments out of it. We just did one. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tomorrow night, the Chicago Symphony Center continues their jazz series with Grammy Award-winning trumpet virtuoso and multi-instrumentalist Nicholas Payton. Payton hails from New Orleans, one of the biggest names to come out of that great music city. He started playing trumpet at 4 years old, and he's been touring since he was 11. What were you doing when you were 11? He won the Grammy for Best Jazz Solo back in 1998. He's taken the genre in several different directions in his career. I mean, he's played standards and classicals and tributes, and he's blended sounds. But what he's doing right now is taking the sounds from his hometown. And in his latest work, he has put together the Afro-Caribbean Mixtape, which is a double album. It's got a little bit of bebop swing, the Great American Songbook, rhythm and blues, hip-hop, and various dialects of Central America and the Caribbean, brought together in a way only Nicholas Payton can. Nicholas Payton and the Afro-Caribbean Mixtape will be on stage tomorrow night, 8 p.m. at the Symphony Center downtown here on Michigan Avenue. And it is my pleasure to welcome Nicholas Payton to the download. He's at the big table tonight. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good to see you, Justin. How you doing, bro?
Where does this come from, this idea of blending all of this music together? Because you have done so much in your career, but you really put an emphasis on the idea of taking music in a different direction.
To me, it's not about blending as much as it is restructuring and reunifying things that were meant to be together in the first place. That genre has sought to kind of separate and marginalize. So that's what this whole album is about, is bringing together all African roots and all black music back to its original source, Africa, and sort of saying that these are all what people call genres, like bebop and swing, hip-hop, funk, soul, R&B.
They all come from the same place, right?
Exactly. They all, even pop music, even the most banal, without listing any names, popular music that you hear on a radio owes a debt to not only Africa, but the world's first pop star, Louis Armstrong.
Really? Louis Armstrong?
He was the first king of pop. All due respect to Michael Jackson. But Louis Armstrong was that dude in 1925, 26 in this city, Chicago. He was in King Oliver's band, and they moved from New Orleans to here. And, like, you know, Chicago was the New York of his time. It was the epicenter. So before he moved to New York and, like, completely changed music there, he was here.
Doing it here, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of your music, and you hear it, and if you don't hear it, you can read the liner notes. But a lot of your history is the music's rooted in history.
Mm.
Has that always been the case for
always.
You? I mean, have you always had one eye on yep. what's come before?
Yep. As the great Dizzy Gillespie said, keep one foot in the past, one foot in the future. And I'm the beneficiary of so many great masters' time and efforts. People like the great Clark Terry.
Mm-hmm.
We once played here at the Jazz Showcase when it was at the Blackstone Hotel.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah. Ahmad Jamal, who, like, you know, like, is the genesis of funk and hip-hop and so many things, who has roots here in Chicago. Elvin Jones, the first gig with Elvin Jones was here, again, at the Blackstone. And Joe Siegel and Wayne, they're still keeping that thing going over there. So it's always about roots and ancestry and elders and lineage when we talk about the tradition and so forth.
You know, for you, you do go out of your way to bust the genres. You know, like you're a lot of times you're classified as a jazz musician.
Right.
And you've gone out of your way to say, you know what, I don't necessarily see myself as a jazz musician because jazz is a genre, like you just said, that is right. Constraints on that.
And like, not a good genre. Like, when it's jazz, something, it's okay if there are two people in a club. It's okay if you only sell 100 CDs. Like, nobody gets into this part of the business to do less and to be marginalized. You want more. You want to have access to the most that you can possibly have.
Well, there was one time, such an interesting art form, that jazz was the pop music.
I mean,
the
20s was right. Branded the jazz age.
So the idea that at one point or another, jazz was a positive genre. I mean, people, you wanted to be associated with that.
I don't know about positive, but it had its term. I mean, when we look at the first jazz band recorded, it was the original Dixieland Jazz Band. And just in the title alone, there's so much wrong with that. Like, original, first of all, they were these, for lack of a better word, white cats appropriating black music, saying they were original. No. Dixieland, we know that has roots to antebellum South. Jazz, which is sort of a truncated version of jive, ASS music. Mm. So it's problematic for a lot of reasons.
As I mentioned earlier, and I want to get into your life, especially as we talk about how you got involved in the music in the first place, come from mm-hmm. a musical family, of course.
Sure.
But, I mean, is that something that was taught to you at a young age? That, you know, if you really truly looked at the genre that you were classified as a musician in, there are some negative stereotypes or some negative connotations just to the name jazz, as you just mentioned. I mean, is that something that you've understood as a young musician coming forward, or is it something that you know, and you were enlightened at an older age?
Yeah, I would say I was perhaps enlightened at an early age. It's funny, though, my trajectory, because initially I was kind of turned off by the idea of jazz as a young person coming up. And then around 11 or 12, I sort of got indoctrinated into jazz to like being in my late 30s and finding my way back to not really digging jazz so much. Because when I was in my youth, I just loved everything. Like, it was all music to me. My father, who played electric bass on a lot of early New Orleanian R&B hits like Lee Dorsey, Working on a Coal Mine, Aaron Neville, Tell It Like It Is. And at a certain point, he didn't want to play electric bass anymore and focus on upright bass. He also played sousaphone in a lot of brass bands. And then this cat, he would teach school in the morning from like 8 to 3 o'clock, the same elementary school I went to, do gigs, maybe sometimes 2 to 3 gigs, 5 to 7 somewhere, 8 to 10, and then midnight to 3, and then come home and practice Bach cello suites for 2 hours before you went to bed and wake up and teach the kids again and do the same thing. So there was never this distinction, you know, so that to me is a learned behavior, mm-hmm. this idea of a genre. It doesn't come from the artist.
It comes from the packaging. Yeah. It comes from the business.
They got to sell something and they got to call it what it is. But I think at least if you can brand yourself, that's at least a better start.
Right.
And that's my whole thing with BAM and Black American Music. If we have to have a brand in this very commercialized society, why not brand ourselves?
Yeah. Black American Music.
That's what it is.
Nicholas Payton, the trumpet virtuoso, here in town because he is playing at the Symphony Center in downtown right here on Michigan Avenue. Tomorrow night, Nicholas Payton and the Afro-Caribbean Mixtape will be on stage starting at 8 o'clock. We'll take a quick break here. We'll come back. We'll talk more with musician Nicholas Payton. Stay with us.
Jazz is a four-letter word. Jazz is a four-letter word.
Jazz doesn't exist.
Jazz is a four-letter word. Jazz is a four-letter word.
Jazz doesn't exist.
It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Listen to little Nicholas Payton, the musician from New Orleans. It's in town at the Chicago Symphony Center for their show tomorrow night, 8 o'clock at the Symphony Center. Nicholas Payton and the Afro-Caribbean Mixtape, which is also the name of the double album, this track we're listening to here. You know, Nicholas, picking up on the conversation, so it's intriguing to me because, you know, when we talk about genres, you are absolutely right that we rarely ever hear an artist say they're a blank musician, a rock musician. I'm a rapper. You know, I'm a jazz musician. That's something that those labels have been put on musicians by not even the consumer, I would say, the business.
Yeah. And labels and so forth.
As you think more about that and you think about that, why isn't that something that is more discussed? Why don't you hear more artists say, you know, I don't put labels on myself, or I'm not a jazz musician, or I'm not a blues musician? What is it that's they just keeping their head down?
I think the artists want to have gigs and they don't want to do anything to disturb that. You know,
and it's as simple as that, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty stupid in that way. Like, I kind of don't care. So, but I mean, I care, but the music and the love of the artists and the ancestry and the community, those are the most important things to me. And at the point of which we begin to sacrifice those things, it becomes something else. So, like, I have to soldier for this thing, mm-hmm. regardless of who else sees it or not.
Well, it's amazing as we saw the music industry kind of crumble in the 2000s, mm. and it all moved to a digital space.
Right.
Those labels moved with it. If you go to iTunes, or you go to Spotify, you go to any of the streaming sites, there's more labels than ever. Mm. I mean, they try to put you in a box, Nicholas Payton, and they tell me who sounds
algorithms
like Nicholas Payton.
If you like this,
you'll do that. Yeah. I mean, if anything, the industry doubled down on that concept of genres and what the artists are supposed to sound
like. In a sense, and then in another sense, like, I've done albums in my bedroom, recorded them,
right.
mixed them, mastered them, and put them out digitally myself, which wasn't really possible in the 90s, late 90s, 2000s. So we're kind of like in the Wild West, like it's wide open with the internet, and it hasn't really settled yet to see what it's going to be. The part I do love about it, that it has empowered the artist to be directly in touch with their own supporters and to be able to put their own product out on their own labels, as I have the past 5 years,
yeah,
my
right.
own Payton Records label. So that's cool.
And I have a couple questions about that, just about running your own record label as a musician. We'll get to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting back to ancestry, history, all the things we were just talking about, that plays so much into the legacy and storyline of your hometown,
definitely.
New Orleans, because I can't put my finger on as a music lover, as somebody who I can't tell you the main style of music that comes out of New Orleans, because there's so much and in different ways. How much does the city of New Orleans and the experience that so many different musicians, jazz, blues, rock, rap, have come out of that area? Mm. That plays into to what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, I mean, from Congo Square, which may have been the only place in America where the enslaved Africans were given a platform to practice their rituals, drumming, dance, singing, music, so forth, to artists like the legendary Buddy Bolden, who spurred on cats like Freddie Keppard and Bunk Johnson and King Oliver, who spurred on the first King of Pop, Louis Armstrong, and people like Jelly Roll Morton, mm-hmm. and Sidney Bechet. And then even throughout the history, even in later years, people like Harold Baptiste or Fats Domino or Dave Bartholomew, and these cats invented what has become rock and roll, to, you know, guys like Terrence Blanchard and Donald Harrison and Harry Connick and so forth, to people like
that's myself,
and Christian Scott and Lil Wayne
and
Cash Money Brothers, yeah. Master P. Like, New Orleans has always had its hand
so diverse
in the pulse of pop music from the beginning to now.
Because of that, coming from New Orleans and having a rich history of being able to defy genres and push boundaries,
mm-hmm.
is it easy to collaborate when you're coming up with a new sound? Like, because really what you're doing here with the Afro-Caribbean mixtape is you're creating, and I use the word because I can't think of another, a new genre.
Hmm.
You know, a concept of music that isn't jazz. It's not pop. It's not hip-hop. It's everything. It's a different sound. So is it easier to collaborate with other musicians from New Orleans because you've all had the history of creating new sounds and creating new things together? Or is it something that goes beyond New Orleans and you can pretty much create new music with any musician?
I think it's both, because if we look at it from a strictly New Orleanian point of view, the only other New Orleans musician on the album is Joe Dyson, who is a drummer. And he's one of the latest in the long line of great New Orleans drummers, from Baby Dodds to, you know, Hurley Riley, Shannon Powell, Adonis Rose, so many great New Orleans drummers. But then we have Vicente Archer, who's been with me since 2002. Kevin Hayes, he's played with me for about that long or earlier. Daniel Sadonik on percussion, and our newest band member, DJ Lady Fingers. And none of which are from New Orleans, but they embody that spirit of pop music. They embody that spirit of African tribal DNA, which I call it, which is the code that sort of underlies most of the music that we hear in a popular strata. So you don't have to be New Orleanian to access that, mm-hmm. no more so than you have to be black to play black music, no more so than you have to be Mexican to play mariachi music, no more so than you have to be Chinese to enjoy a noodle or Italian to enjoy pasta. It's just acknowledging where something comes from and tying yourself into that root and tradition if you want to be a part of that lineage.
Are most musicians that you work with, are they this articulate about breaking down the boundaries? Or is music the language that they speak? Because I read your liner notes, you do things that too late.
Words
you do
are, other. Yeah, words conscious.
Yeah, you're
person.
Definitely you're up on the up on the box.
I don't know if every musician is that, but I'm just that kind of person outside of the music. Like, words are very important to me. Mm-hmm. So what words I choose to voice whatever expression or emotion are of particular importance
to tell the story of the music.
Yeah,
yeah. Nicholas Payton, my guest, great musician, Grammy Award winning musician, who is going to be at the Chicago Symphony Center tomorrow night. Nicholas Payton and the Afro-Caribbean Mixtape. It'll be at 8:00 at the Symphony Center. We'll take a quick break here. We'll get an update with Rob Martyr, and then we'll come back. And I want to talk about, you've spent your entire life in music.
Pretty much.
We talked about 4 years old, you're picking up the trumpet. Mm-hmm. 11 years old, you're on tour. Mm. I want to know about the life lessons. I want to know about the things that you've picked up, what you've learned, how that has shaped you as a human being.
Cool.
We'll talk about that. Nicholas Payton, my guest at the big table tonight. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. This is Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight at the big table, musician Nicholas Payton. Trumpet virtuoso, multi-instrumentalist, Grammy Award winner, is at the Chicago Symphony Center tomorrow night with his show Nicholas Payton and the Afro-Caribbean Mixtape. It's at 8:00 right here, Michigan Avenue. As we mentioned, coming out of when we went to the news with Rob, I kind of said at the beginning, you start playing trumpet at the age of 4 years old. What does that mean? You see it all the time in bios, but what does it mean to be 4 years old picking up the trumpet?
Yeah, I just wanted to play it. You know, that was the first, and I grew up around music. Both of my parents played music. My mom, a former operatic singer and classically trained pianist. My dad played bass and sousaphone of all sorts. But trumpet, something just called me of that instrument. And New Orleans obviously having such a rich history of great trumpet players, just something about that instrument spoke to me. So my father, I said I wanted to play trumpet, and he bought me a pocket trumpet, which is a little more compact version of the normal B-flat trumpet we usually see. It's of the oak of what Don Cherry used. So it's about like a third of the size, so you don't tip over when you're four. And I've been playing trumpet pretty much ever since.
When you pick it up and you start playing around with it,
mm-hmm.
and it's an instrument that a lot of people have probably dabbled with and banned in high school or maybe in grade school, what have you. But what is it about the instrument that kept you focused? I mean, what was it? Because you could easily see as a kid at 4 years old, at 6 years old, saying, I want to play guitar. I want to do something else. Or I don't want to do music at all. Mm-hmm. What was it about this instrument, the trumpet, that kept you involved?
It's interesting. I would say maybe every trumpet player must have, by virtue of picking that instrument and staying with it, some sort of masochistic thing, because
why?
It is the hardest instrument. Like, you can see saxophone players and drummers playing well into their 90s, sounding like they did in their 30s. You don't find too many trumpet players in their 90s at that level. One of the few who I've had the pleasure to work with and see is the great Doc Cheatham, who played until the day he passed. I'm a multi-instrumentalist, so I feel validated to say this. It is the most difficult instrument, just physically, to have metal on one of the most tender parts of your body, your lips, and to blow compressed air through a tiny little tube and to be required to play music.
And to be able to manipulate that. That's crazy.
Night after night, like, it's crazy.
There is a lot that goes into. I mean, when you start to get serious with the instrument, do you have to think about your breathing? Do you have to think about? Yeah. I mean, you're taking care of your mouth, things like that.
Justin, what you just said right there, I give lessons to trumpet players in their 30s and 40s who don't understand the breathing. That's your fuel, because you focus on the lips and everybody's focused on musculature and chops and whatever. The air, that's your fuel. If you don't take a proper breath before you play, then you won't have the fuel to drive your car on the freeway. And that's it. So something that's very elemental and fundamental to our development as babies even is breathing. We find ourselves having to recapture in our older age.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the whole romanticism behind yoga and spirituality and arts and breath. 20, 30, and 40-year-olds learning how to breathe again because we've forgotten how to do it. Same thing with trumpet players. So, yeah, a lot of the work, most chop problems, lip problems have to do with not taking proper breath. And Chicago has a big hand in that. The great, late great Arnold Jacobs, who was a tubist with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, which was housed at where we're playing tomorrow, Orchestra Hall. He taught a lot of the foremost experts in the breath field, people who I've had the pleasure of studying with, like the great Vincent Chickowitz, who played trumpet under Herseth in the CSO Brass, the great Bill Fielder, also the great Vincent Pinzarella.
So there's a whole, breathing technique.
Just breathing.
Wow.
And I always tell a lot of my, and I'm giving some insider information out for free. There's two tubists who created a DVD called The Breathing Gem. And it's all just 50 minutes of breathing exercises away from the horn. That will do so much just for improving most brass players' conception of moving when.
Okay, so now you've got the technique down. You understand what it means to play the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
But talk about your connection to the instrument and connection to being a musician, the soul of it, the heart of it. What attracted you when you got a little bit older?
Mm.
Now you understand how it works, and like you said, we just went through all that. What was it that kept you going? What was the connection, the love that kept you with the trumpet?
Great question. It's something I believe I've always had with me, but became apparent when I studied with a great trumpeter, Vincent Pinzarella, and his teacher, Arnold Jacob, who wrote a book, I think it's called Wind and Song. But later, Jacob even sort of revised his thought and said, if I was really proper, I would say it's song and wind because it's the song that gets you the wind. So as a trumpet player, you don't know exactly how much you have to tighten your lips to make a high C, how much air you have to take. You hear the note, and the body knows what to do. So the idea is to get out of the way. So the clearer your conception of what you hear, the better you're going to be able to have the facility to execute that. And I think for me, I've always had that on my side, even though technically I didn't maybe have the best teachers early on. I mean, it took me 30 years just to learn how to practice. Because I kind of had a good ear and I could just naturally hear and play better than a lot of my peers. But at a certain point, it became called upon me to do something different if I wanted to really get inside this music and have the longevity. I didn't want to be like certain trumpet players that I saw toppling out at 50, 60 years old and couldn't play anymore, and being on stage and not really be at your best. So I really reevaluated myself in my 30s to try to have a breadth of knowledge that would take me.
And that's tremendous for all the kids who would be out there who are trying trumpet or practicing, and they're like, I'm not getting anywhere, I'm not understanding it. To hear you, Nicholas Payton, Grammy Award winner, say you're in your 30s learning
after
how
the
to
Grammys.
After the Grammys,
yeah,
relearning how to practice.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, so we've got, tremendous conversation here. Nicholas Payton, the Grammy Award-winning trumpet player and multi-instrumentalist. He's going to be at the Symphony Center tomorrow night, 8 o'clock. You know, there's that part. And then there's the part, the life of the musician. At 11 years old, you're touring.
Mm-hmm.
You're touring with your family. You're starting to be a touring musician.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. Talk about, the two things. I'll ask the question two ways. One, how amazing it was for an 11-year-old to see the world that way.
Mm.
And then I would say the challenges of an 11-year-old seeing the world that way.
Well, fortunately for me, I was blessed with two parents who instilled certain levels of independence in me early on. They gave me a voice. They allowed me when I was two years old to say what was cool and what was not cool. And I think when I was 11 years old, starting to go on the road, they trusted me to know. I knew the difference between right and wrong. And even if some musicians were trying to coerce me into some unsavory areas, that I would have the strength and the fortitude to say, you know, guys, mm-hmm. I don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. So that was really it. It was their rearing and their forward parenting and their selflessness to allow me to be my own creative being, even though I was their child.
Do you feel at all, to think about being a prodigy, to be on the road at 11 years old, do you feel like you became an adult too quick? I mean, do you feel like you experienced
in a sense, yeah. But I think I'm experiencing a elongated childhood now. I feel at 43, I feel younger than ever. So this is great because now I have the knowledge of a 40-year-old, but can recapture that spirit of a child. And that's really the hardest thing to maintain is that love for the music when I first got my trumpet and I took it home. Because there's so many distractions in the world. There's so many things that can take you out of that space. To keep that love, I still have that love. I still have that burning desire.
What gets in the way? What douses that love? Is it money?
The business.
The business?
It could be money, fame, popularity, Grammys, all the accolades that sort of say, oh, you're here and you have arrived.
Keep doing this.
I've never felt that. I feel like I'm just beginning right now. I'm excited about tomorrow night like it's my first performance. You know, that like no one can take that away from you.
As an artist, as a creator, someone who continues to defy the genres and push yourself and push the boundaries, does that only apply to art? Do you find yourself as a human being thinking the same way? Is your brain sort of in a position where you're always pushing boundaries?
Art and musicianship are somewhat even like the byproducts. It's ultimately the life of the person that matters most, the life of a being. And then that sort of translates into and permeates all the other facets of your life.
Can you, as a musician, as a esteemed musician, can you listen to the music that you've done or the music that you've written or performed and know where you were mm-hmm. as a human being?
Definitely. Some things for that very reason I can't listen to.
Really?
Because it's that honest. But I think for the most part I've made honest music and music that I'm proud of, even from my first album. Like I waited for many years because I had pretty much all the major labels hitting me up to sign me from being like 15, 16 years old. And I put that off until like 19, 20, till I felt I was ready, till I felt like I had served tutelage under enough. And it wasn't like I felt like I'm a bad cat right now, I'm ready. But just that I had learned enough that it would be an honest, respectable first effort, you know?
It makes me think too, just about, you know, do you have to, discipline and censoring yourself in the way that the discipline of being prepared and ready to create. Mm. But at the same time, you know, if you're not ready, are you censoring yourself as an artist?
That too, and maybe being the victim of too much ability and talent. So censoring yourself in a way where you're like editing, not putting everything out there all the time, which in this very social media, YouTube-driven era of getting likes and going viral, you have cats doing all kinds of things which I feel are not very artistic or musical for garnering attention. You know what I mean? So to have the trust in yourself and the belief and the artistic sensibility to know when to withhold, to not just put everything out there, every single beat, every single bar, to have that level of restraint, to know when to let something go, when to play something and when not to play something. That's a very learned behavior, you know, when not to play.
When not to play. Tomorrow night, you're on stage. As you mentioned, you have ties to Orchestra Hall, Symphony mm-hmm. Center. You have not only played in tremendous clubs around the country, but you've played on tremendous stages. Mm-hmm. For you to be on stage, and you look forward to that, Name the one part of it that you're looking forward to the most. Like, and I don't mean like, oh, it's going to be fun. I can't wait to be here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you're going to be on stage for an hour plus, 2 hours, whatever it is. What's the one part for Nicholas Payton that you always look forward to in a concert like tomorrow night that you're going to be on stage?
I'm there to touch people and make them move. And even though Orchestra Hall is not necessarily set up to dance, but I want to see them dancing. If I can't even see their feet moving, at least dancing in their eyes. Coming from New Orleans, in a tradition where people second line and at any moment there can be a parade breaking down the street, I want that sensibility to always be present in my music, regardless of the environment.
Trumpeter, multi-instrumentalist, Grammy Award winner, Nicholas Payton. He will be on stage tomorrow night. Nicholas Payton and the Afro-Caribbean Mixtape, 8 o'clock at the Symphony Center Orchestra Hall, right here on Michigan Avenue. Nicholas Payton, a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for being my guest at the Big Table tonight.
Thank you, Justin.
Great combo there. I when you get a guy like Nicholas Payton to come in studio and be able to honestly have a conversation about what makes him an artist, I don't know, man. You take that opportunity every time because, you know, we've had a lot of musicians on and a lot of artists who may not be that forthcoming about or that thoughtful about. I mean, even down, I think he's absolutely right. When you start thinking about genres and you start thinking about they're not even genres anymore, they're categories. And you hear all the time artists say, I don't want to be put in a cat. I don't want to be put in a box. And we accept it in some forms. You know, if it's someone on TV or whatever, he's not a dramatic actor. He's a comedy. You can't put George Clooney in a box. We'll accept that. But when Nicholas Payton says, I don't want to be called a jazz musician because I play so much more. And jazz musician is automatically, you're trying to put me into a package, trying to wrap me up on one of those old, you know, flat CDs from the 80s that, you know, the whole paper long, that's what I think of jazz.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, it's true. And then when you talk about what it takes to actually play the trumpet and get into technique, it's the kind of thing that you should send an email to your 12-year-old son or daughter who's struggling with the trumpet right now in band and be like, listen to this. This guy will tell you what's up.
How about that?
Right? Really good.
When we were, it made me want to go back to New Orleans. We were just there in the spring, and there's this place called Bacchanal. It's a wine bar. It's in this cool neighborhood, and they had like a beer garden in the back, beer and wine garden, really nice. And they have they had a jazz band playing up on stage, and it was great. He was a trumpeter actually, but he would start off every other song. He was like, this one was a song written in 1914 by Jelly Roll Morton. Every song was written like 100 years ago by Jelly Roll Morton.
Well, it's just always, and it makes me think about, and we talked about this with Chicago jazz musicians, and I always think about an experience I had as a young, I mean, I was maybe 20 years old, maybe a little bit older, and I was working in a different shop here, and I was working with Richard Steele, who we had on the show,
yeah.
Richard Steele, a longtime journalist here in town, and he was doing a story on Von Freeman and the Apartment Lounge, and it's a South Side bar. And it's no different than, it's a smaller version of like the Matchbox or the Hideout or just this sort of, you know, a dive bar from
sure.
Chicago
yeah.
with a pub, you know, with a sign mm-hmm. out front. And it was a thin bar and you went in the back and there's a small stage, wasn't even as big as the board that I'm sitting in front of. And on it was Von Freeman, bass player, saxophone, trumpet, drums, and they were doing jam sessions on Tuesday night, and he had kids from University of Chicago and other places come over, and it was like the biggest concert of the week. There was so much energy in the room. These kids were nervous, and people were there. There were dates. They were dressed up. I mean, it was like a whole thing for this sort of dive bar on the South Side, the Apartment Lounge. And he would get up there and I put so much, I don't want to denigrate the music, you know, when I say, well, they made it up on stop. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like they improvised and they just went with the flow, not unlike what Nicholas was just talking about, the idea of defying a genre and just kind of going with the flow. And each instrument that was brought in had its own flow. It was so interesting. And I think about those experiences and I'm like, those are esteemed adults here I am at 20 years old, esteemed adults, you know, making music and creating the way they want to create.
Yeah.
And it opened my eyes to be like, there's a lot going on. Dude. You don't have to be a pop. You don't have to do a 4-minute pop song and be in the studio in L.A. going, oh, baby, come and work for me. You know, like there's a lot.
Other things.
There's a lot going on out there. So anyway, great conversation tonight with Nicholas Payton. I really enjoyed that. Yeah.
I know, because up till tonight, everything that I knew about jazz was from Ryan Gosling.
I should have asked him what he thought of La La Land. I still have to see that. I missed that. I had a whole thing where I was going to go see that. I remember trying to go. My 9-year-old son saw it before I did.
Oh.
I know, right?
Did he like it?
He did. And I need to ask him more about it because he's like, yeah, it's good. Like, he just didn't really go into it.
Yeah.
I don't think that. And I don't know what to go. I didn't see it, so I couldn't really push him on what it was. All right, coming up, we'll talk some history, Chicago baseball history. Jackie Robinson came to Chicago 70 years ago today to a super sold out Wrigley Field, as well as the surrounding area. Jerry Pritikin, the Bleacher Preacher, was there 1947, and he is in studio tonight to talk about that amazing historic day in Chicago. And we'll talk to him coming up here after the news. Stay with us.
Did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? It went zoom across the left field wall. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes, Jackie hits that ball.
When he swung his bat, the crowd went wild because he knocked that ball a solid mile. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes, Jackie hits that ball. Satchel Paige's Mellon, so is Campanella, Newcomb and Dobie too. But it's a natural fact, when Jackie comes to bat, the other team is through. Boy,
did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? Did he hit it? Boy, and that ain't all he stole home.
Yeah, yes, I could play that all night. That's a good one. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, today was a tremendous day in Chicago baseball history. 70 years ago, May 18th, 1947, the Brooklyn Dodgers came to Wrigley Field for a regular season game, and it was the first time that an African-American player was in said game. Jackie Robinson went 0-for-4 that day, but the Dodgers phenom drew 46,572 fans, which still holds as the largest paid regular season attendance in Wrigley Field history. And that doesn't even count the estimated 20,000 people who gathered around Wrigley that day just to get a glimpse at history. One little boy that was lucky enough to be in attendance was none other than Jerry Pritikin, the famed Bleacher Preacher who spent years out at Wrigley Field in the bleachers trying to convert opposing teams' fans. Jerry's in studio tonight to talk about the game. Jerry, great to see you.
I'm glad to be here.
10 years old.
Right.
You were 10 years old. So let's talk about this. Amazing experience when you saw this was coming up and you realized it was 70 years. What automatically came into your head?
Well, my brother and I both were at that game, and we discussed what has happened since that game. And it was a changing of the guard. Baseball changed for the best. And we were there to witness it. And it's one of those things. My father used to love telling us about his good old days, and now I'm talking about my good old days.
Well, Jerry, talk about that day, because you were 10 years old. Did you know, I mean, to think about as a young Cubs fan, did you know how important it was that Jackie Robinson was coming to town?
Well, I knew the change was coming. I was reading the sporting news in those days and, of course, read about. They used to report on the minor leagues, too. And I read about Jackie the year before when he was at Montreal. And then, of course, in January, they started making announcements. And we didn't realize how great a change was coming, but we knew a change was coming. And what was unique is, happened to go to the opener that year and happened to see Hank Greenberg in his first National League game, a 2-out double in the 6th inning. He drove in the first and only run of the game, and he was the first $100,000 player at that time. So I was able to see, unique history in that sense. And then just about a week or so later, my brother and I happened to be at the ballpark. It was Babe Ruth Day. And they were piping in from Yankee Stadium, Babe Ruth giving like a farewell speech. And unfortunately, the PA system was not the greatest. I kept tugging at my brother and saying, what did he say? What did he say? but I knew I was listening to the Babe, and I was in awe. And it was unique to say, hey, that's Babe Ruth I'm listening to. And then just a few weeks later, here we go with Jackie Robinson.
It's amazing to think that that year, I mean, 1947, it's Babe Ruth Day, the changing of the guard to go from Babe Ruth and everything he meant to baseball to a new chapter, Jackie Robinson, as a 10-year-old. And you read the papers, you know what's happening, you're reading sporting news. Take us back, if you can, to that day. Did you know that this was such a coveted ticket that people wanted to come out and see Jackie Robinson?
We were aware of it, but we didn't realize how it was going to change things. And fortunately, I lived in a great area in Chicago called Albany Park, and we wanted to be there, my brother and I. And, you know, it happened to be a Sunday. And we left the house very early because we knew there was going to be a lot of people. 47,000, no way did we think that. But we took the big red streetcars from Albany Park. We had to take two of them, the Lawrence Avenue to Clark Street. And Clark Street, we had to get off four blocks before Wrigley Field because there were so many people coming to the ballpark that they were lined up that they couldn't go any further. So getting off four blocks before that and then getting into a long line. You got to remember, there was no charge cards in those days.
Cash,
I would say
99%
right. of the people paid cash to go into the park. So it's amazing to think that they were able to get 47,000 people in on time for the beginning of the
so
game.
So they would just line up. There wasn't sort of you can go and get the tickets a day in advance. Like you had to line up to get into the park.
Right. Of course, there was many box offices open at that time. And we decided we were going to sit in the grandstands. And fortunately, because we did get there early, we were able to get a seat. And many people would ask us, how is it possible they had 47,000 people there? Well, there were no fire laws in those days. And thus, there was people sitting in the aisles on the steps along under the grandstands, along the fences in the back, and in the upper deck along the fences, and, of course, out in the bleachers along the fences there. So I didn't count them one by one, but I do remember the next day, I didn't really realize that it was that many until I read the Daily News the next day, and they had a picture.
But you were going to Wrigley Field, right?
Right.
So you knew that there were more people at this game than before.
Than ever before, sure, because there were times they used to close off the upper deck because there wasn't enough people in, to come out to the ball game. So it was an amazing event. And here again, Mr. Robinson only he came to the plate four times. He took two called third strikes. It wasn't anything of a magnitude of getting a hit and on base like we got to see all season long afterwards. How he kept the pitchers from almost giving him a heart attack when he got on base because he was so eager to get to the next base.
Jerry Pritikin's my guest in studio tonight, the bleacher preacher, talking about his day when he was 10 years old, 70 years ago, May 18th, 1947, when the Brooklyn Dodgers and Jackie Robinson came to Wrigley Field for the first time. Let's take a quick break. We'll continue conversation because we skipped past. I mean, you've done such a good job of explaining how you got to the park, the lines. I want to know more about the at-bats. I want to know more about the climate, the environment. We'll do that right after the break. Jerry Pritikin in studio. Stay with us. It's Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here. Jerry Pritikin in studio, the Bleacher Preacher. We're talking about 70 years ago, May 18th, 1947. The Brooklyn Dodgers came to Wrigley Field, and Jackie Robinson was the first African-American player to play at Wrigley Field. Jerry was there, 10 years old, talking about the experience. You know, today the Chicago Cubs, They put a flag up for Jackie Robinson. And but there hasn't been a lot of fanfare about this event. It's surprising because it's 70 years. It's a big deal. It seems like this is kind of an event, but it doesn't seem like there's a lot for it.
I'm really surprised. But then again, like my father is not here, and a lot of my relatives aren't here, and that is a long time ago. And I might like to think of myself still as a kid, but when I look in the mirror, I look more like my father than I do myself. So I realize 70 years is a long period.
Yeah.
And thus, there's probably not that many people who fortunate like I was to be there at the game. And, of course, they didn't have televisions in their houses at that time. So radio would be the only other way they could have heard of what was happening.
Right. Well, let's get back to that game, what you remember from being a 10-year-old Cubs fan who would come out to the park. All right, so like we said, I mean, you kind of glossed quick about Jackie Robinson, 0-for-4, 2 called strikeouts. But talk about the experience. When Jackie Robinson came to the plate for the first time for the Brooklyn Dodgers in that first inning, I don't know what he was batting, but what was the response like? What was the crowd like?
I'm glad to say there was a good ovation from the crowd. In fact, the only boo that day, and I could remember, was for Dixie Walker. And Dixie Walker was booed every time he came to Chicago.
Why? What was Dixie Walker?
Well,
I don't know my Cubs baseball history enough to know.
Dixie Walker did. I guess he was, and I don't want to put it into a Confederate, but when you call yourself Dixie, he just didn't give us any reason to cheer him. But then, of course.
Was he on the Dodgers or was he in the Cubs?
He was with the Dodgers a long time. And in fact, he had a brother, nice. Harry the Hat Walker, who once led the National League in batting, but he played for.
So there was an ovation for Jackie Robinson.
Yes, a cheer, a warmth. And one of the things I noticed, and I've read a lot about this event because I witnessed it, many of the fans brought binoculars with them for the game. And I've been to many games since, and I have never seen that, where a great many, thousands of people brought binoculars to get a better look at this future Hall of Famer.
Wow, that's amazing to me. Take us back to 1947. You would know, 10 years old, maybe you're not paying attention too much to race relations and tensions in America, but were people bringing binoculars because they really wanted to get a close look at an African-American in a baseball uniform? Or were they looking at, did they recognize the idea that this was history and this player was phenomenal?
I think they realized the history behind it, and you got to remember, this was a Sunday, and there was a great amount of black people at the ballpark, more so than I have ever seen up until that point. And there was a great amount of people who had gone to church that day. So people didn't get dressed in T-shirts and baseball caps back then. If you take a look at the old-time pictures,
yeah,
you never
up.
See a baseball
right,
hat.
Right, you got to have a fedora, right?
So many people remarked that many of the blacks were in their Sunday best. Well, they were in their Sunday best because more than likely they had come from church, as well as many other white people did. So it was an atmosphere, not that you get in today's game where everybody is more casual.
Right.
So
that's interesting.
I do not remember any boos. I do not remember any razzing. It's just that everybody came there. I don't want to say they have a good time, especially when the Cubs lose, but at the same time, we sensed something. As a kid, I sensed something. But there was like a buzz going around that you knew something was happening here that you never saw up until that time, and we didn't realize the impact that it had maybe for a long while to come.
You know, when I think about that, how many times does a fan get the opportunity to be in a stadium, a park, in any sport really, where history is being made? And you've been, as the bleacher preacher, as someone who is a diehard Cub fan who's been in the bleachers, you're a big part of the Chicago culture and the lore of Cub fans. Have you ever experienced anything like that again?
No, but not that I can remember. A few years back, the Cubs did have a Japanese ball player, and it had a unique experience at the time, the first time that he showed up. And they were more into marketing Fukudome's becoming a Cub. But there wasn't a marketing, like T-shirts or jackets.
For Jackie Robinson.
Even tennis or anything.
There's no 42 T-shirts being sold.
You were witnessing it. And I didn't, my father taught me how to keep a great scorecard, but I didn't want to do a scorecard that day. I really just wanted to watch what was happening.
You just wanted to watch the environment, watch what was happening.
I learned to dislike the Dodgers when they were in Brooklyn as much as I dislike them now than when they're in Los Angeles. However, I always respected good ball players, no matter who they played for. And the Dodgers did have quite a few interesting young ball players. And this is just only a couple years post World War II. When I started going to the games in 45, I didn't understand because many of the players had gray hair. And I didn't realize that, if you were not 4F, you were in the trenches. You weren't in the ballpark
right,
playing.
You're fighting, right.
But to see more youthful-looking ball players for me was interesting because I thought all ball players were older than my father.
That's awesome. Jerry, it's a tremendous part of American history, not just baseball, but American history. To be a 10-year-old, to be in that park, to have had the career you've had being a diehard Cubs fan and being a character at the park, what's it mean to you that you had the amazing experience to be in the ballpark when Jackie Robinson came to Chicago?
No, it's probably up until last year, the most unique feeling I had witnessing a ball game. I did get to see a lot of ball players who turned out later to become Hall of Famers. I got to see some of the old-time players who, before they bowed out, I was able to see them in person. One of my favorite pastimes of reading the sport pages was there was always a column, I believe, Arch Ward, The Wake of the News, and at the bottom of it, they had 10 years ago today, and they would mention ballplayers' names of ballplayers that were no longer there or who had become famous, and I can almost visualize what I was reading. Well, as I got a little bit older, 10 and more, all of a sudden, the 10 years I could say, hey, I remember that, instead of reading about it. And this was one of my beginning of remembering of who I've been watching. One of the things I got to mention that I'm happy for majority of the Cub fans. I never heard anybody boo Stan Musial. We respected good ball players. I wasn't taught to hate personally, and I think that's something that I'm glad I don't remember.
It is interesting because you're talking about decades of watching Chicago Cubs baseball, and there have been some we saw just this year. Adam Jones is Baltimore Orioles, and racial taunts from the Boston bleachers. We've heard in Chicago has had that problem where there have been some times in Chicago Cubs history with the players that were underachieving and race was brought in. There is this kind of connection with the Cubs and some racial tension around some ball players. But I mean, when you think about, like you just said, the idea of being at the game where Jackie Robinson came and the warm reception, I mean, you try to dispel those myths.
Well, I just got to throw out that I think only once did I can recall being stupid, and I picked on Frank Robinson. There were stories in the sport pages and whatnot that he had a gun. I didn't understand why he carried a gun, but unfortunately there was a need to protect himself. But as a kid or growing a couple years older, I didn't know that, and I kept saying, where's your gun? Where's your gun? Well, I was happy to say I met Frank when he was the manager at the Giants, and I apologized to him.
Did he remember? Yeah, he probably general taunts, right?
But I could honestly say I did write him a letter many years later apologizing, but he didn't remember that. But I remember thinking how stupid I was. I mean,
that's fandom.
After reading more about how what he had to put up with as a ball player, let alone on the field and off the field. So looking back, I don't blame him. In fact, I probably would have had a Tommy gun.
J. Jerry Pritikin, the bleacher preacher, giving us his story of being a 10-year-old in the grandstands at Wrigley Field for the May 18th, 1947 game where the Brooklyn Dodgers and Jackie Robinson came to Wrigley Field. Still the highest attendance in regular season history at Wrigley Field. Jerry was there. Jerry, thanks so much for sharing your memories and being a guest tonight.
Well, I got one more memory to go for, and that is back-to-back World Series. And we can look forward to that. And I realized you can't judge a team in April or May. It's what's at the end of the year where you're at that time. Right. And I would like to be invited back for the repeat for that.
You'll be there. You'll be here. We'll invite you here. You can talk about your prediction of the back-to-back World Series. Jerry, good to see you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720, the death of Chris Cornell today. The lead singer, Soundgarden, was a seminal Seattle grunge rock band that really like put that whole scene. You think about Pearl Jam, Nirvana, I guess Nirvana, same, but I always think Pearl Jam and Soundgarden kind of one and the same. Tough to hear they said the reason of death was suicide. That's what they're looking into, which is it's a bummer to hear. Of course, when anybody takes their life, but also someone who had such an impact on so many people's lives, and I hope he knew that. I hope he knew that a lot of young people who are now adults listened to and were inspired by Soundgarden. I know I was. Pete, you were. It's a tough, sad day in music today, the death of Chris Cornell. Yeah, I feel like, I don't know how much. I always feel like Soundgarden was the one band of the Alice in Chains, the Soundgardens, the Pearl Jams. It's like I knew their big hit. They had their hits. Mm-hmm. But I never really went deep with them. Too much screaming for me.
And he got that voice.
Yeah,
you gotta use it
right. They had a song. They had a single, or man, yeah. They had a song on the single soundtrack.
Did yeah, they, of course. I think he was also an actor.
He was in that movie, right? Yeah, I feel like I miss that. I lived that moment. Like that's my generation's, your generation's music. And of course, Pearl Jam. And I remember seeing Soundgarden at an early Lollapalooza,
sure, yeah.
Alpine Valley. Might even been the same bill, or maybe the year after was Pearl Jam, and where Eddie Vedder climbs up the rafters, and hangs from the lighting rigs, while "Why Go Home" or "Even Flow" is on, and then Soundgarden too. But yeah, Soundgarden to me was always a screamy band.
But then you have, your sensitive Black Hole Sun,
right.
Your Fell on Black Days.
My problem, and this is a change direction, but I always had a problem with, as a kid who was 20, 21, 22 years old, during sort of the alternative rock movement, is I really didn't connect with Q101, if that makes sense. So Q101 was...
JVO is not listening.
Yeah, he was great. I always liked James. But I never... They were playing a homogenized version of it. That's like when they would play the Smashing Pumpkins' Rat in a Cage. That song.
Yeah.
Or Soundgarden was a heavy rotation on Q101.
Oh, yeah.
Then you'd have like a New Order or the Cranberries.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of stuff. And I just never... I got to a vibe that it felt like that music was the commercialization of the alt movement. And I was at Columbia College at the time. I just felt like, I'll get into my stuff that's not played on Q101.
Oh, yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, I was the same way. Yeah, that was,
Soundgarden,
it was like the commercial radio.
Yeah, Soundgarden, unfortunately to me, fell into that category. So
mm-hmm.
I wanted to like him, and I liked him before that. And then they just got played in rotation. I had a roommate in college, too, who just played Soundgarden all the time. I'm like, this is not for you. Stop it.
I had a lot of bands like that where I liked their first album, like Soul Asylum. I liked their first couple of records, and then, you know, they were on MTV all the time, and I'm like, oh, you know,
perfect,
oh, really, Runaway
perfect.
Train. Yes. Yeah, I lost interest.
Right. That is a perfect band for what we're talking about. When you got somebody to shove or whatever, and you're like, waiting by the phone. You're like, oh, this is a jam. I like this. Maybe they're playing on MTV all the time, but I like it.
Yeah.
And then Q101 just played it in heavy rotation. Then they got their second one, Runaway Train. Here's Runaway Train.
Yep.
No more Runaway. No, no.
Yep.
And then it was like, at a certain point, that became like Light FM. You're playing Runaway Train. You could still play. You can hear it on Light FM, you know?
Oh, yeah. I'm with you on that whole thing.
Yeah. Like, so there was, so unfortunately for me, I didn't go deep enough on Soundgarden. They fell into that category, so I kind of already kind of pushed them to the side.
I think it all had to do with, like, I wasn't interested in what was popular. You know, that was, like, part of the personality. I'm like, oh, they sold out. I got to dig deeper, you know. But then, like, as you grow up, you're like, what was I just missing out on good music. What was I doing? You go back, and you're like, oh, yeah, it was fine. It's fine. It's just music. You know, it's enjoyable.
And it's funny, too, because some of those songs that were on at that time that I would have judged at the time, they show up now, Saturday morning flashback or on, you know, on iTunes or something. And I turn to my son. I'm like, jam! Oh, there's a jam.
Right.
Like, I've lost all that judgment. Like, any judgment that was happening, that's gone. It's like as you know, years go by, you're like, oh, man, this Tears for Fears is a jam. You know, this Depeche Mode is killing it. Depeche Mode's another one of those that I just never, I wanted to, and I would love to talk. If there was ever had an opportunity to interview the guys from Depeche Mode, I'd do it in a heartbeat. But I think at the time it was one of those things where I'm like,
yeah,
didn't really.
Yep, same thing. There was a DJ on Q101. Steve Fisher?
Yeah,
Steve
right.
Fisher.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's been around, you know, been around a number of stations, you know, pretty big guy here. I remember I was working at the Prudential Building, and I was walking to the Blue Line at the time on Lake Street. I'm walking down Randolph, and I see a purse, like, laying on the ground. I pick it up. I look. I'm like, oh, man, what's this? So I take it home with me. I start investigating.
Yeah. See what you can get for it.
Get the ID. And I don't even know what I did at the time. It was, you know, like, I don't know. I think the person had a checkbook, and I called them. And it was an older woman, and I met her downtown to give her back her stuff. And it was Steve Fisher's mom.
Classic.
Yeah. And I think this is, like, right around the time where she's like, my son works in radio. And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure he does. It's like Steve Fisher. I'm like, I was listening to him yesterday.
He was a teacher of mine at Columbia. So, yeah, it's funny to think about that, like, back to those days. I mean, it was around the same time. Well, maybe he was teaching classes. Mom, just go walk around downtown. Just go walk around. So check out the L. Go down Lake Street. What I was saying earlier was we should come up with new characters for the bleachers for the Cubs. It's just so expensive to get in there. But get Wrigley Field, like, you know, like Jerry was a bleacher preacher, you know, and there's all the bleacher bums.
Right.
But we should double down on the idea of a 1940s fan where we dress in, like, three-piece suits and show up almost like a older version of the Blues Brothers with fedoras and the whole bit, and then do, like, you're a bum. You know, like the guys from the 40s, and they show up in the bleachers, and we're big party guys, and we still drink, and we, you know, we rile up the crowd. Everyone loves us, and we become, as the team gets closer and closer to the World Series, we become almost the cult heroes.
Yeah, the guys. Yeah, a lot of local news segments.
Yeah, we'd be to local news. I mean, I really, it would be me and you. We get Martyr as well.
Oh, yeah.
Esmeralda as well. And we all dress up in three-piece suits like it's the 40s.
Yeah, fancy clothes.
Fancy clothes like we're Sunday's best.
Mm-hmm.
And we act like we're from the 40s, so we just make a bunch of old-timey, you're a bum. Like, you know, you'll always be a bum. That kind of thing. I think it's gold. I don't know what I mean, the problem would be the commitment, because you can't just go once a year. You'd have to go at least 10 times.
Yeah, you have to be seen. You have to go a number of times to be seen, and people start to recognize you. Like there was a couple of years ago where the people, there was two dudes that dressed up as the Blues Brothers that always kind of ended up behind the home plate.
So the idea of, and you'd have to get some TV coverage so people are like, yeah, some fans enjoying the game, Casper's up there. And that kind of thing.
Yep.
The problem would be that I'm thinking like a tweed, you know, like a tweed suit, three-piece, going to get hot.
Yeah.
It's going to stink, which is part of the allure. Anyone who's been too close to the characters know that they're not necessarily
ripe.
Yeah, they're not. Hygiene's not their thing. Cheering for the Cubs is. No one's ever said, oh, man, Roddy Woo Woo smells so good, right? So we don't necessarily worry about our body odor. I think that'll play out.
Well, I'm up for that.
Yeah, we can go get a small loan so we can go to these games. Or maybe we go to the Cubs with this plan. Like, we should see if we can get a meeting with the Cubs marketing brass and, like, do a PowerPoint with a model and everything, and we have a model of the field in our presentation, and it'd show the two of us. Sitting there, a bunch of other little Lego guys, you know, and they were like, this is what it would look like. And then we do like a video. We could do a lot and make this. And then maybe they would say at the end of the day, they'd be like, all right, we'll give you discounted tickets. You don't have to pay, you know, the going rate. We'll give you the friends and family discount.
It's still a little steep, though.
What's a bleacher ticket go for these days? What is it? $7?
No.
$8.50?
Like $50.
What? Where have I been?
I think for like the weekend summer games, it's around 50.
Maybe that's part of our rub too. We complain about, how much is this beer?
Yeah.
In my day. Yeah.
This ticket costs $3.50.
A beer should be 25 cents. Like that kind of thing. What are these nachos? What is this sauce you put on your chips? What was it? I just want it all. I want a Frankfurter. And a 25-cent Schlitz. I don't know what the beer would be at 1947. I think it'd be great. And then we can be like invited to parties. People have like parties, Cubs parties around the playoffs, and they're like, "Who's here? It's the 1940s guys."
Yep. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
And then we come up with a dance routine. So every time we go anywhere, we have boombox, like we're strippers. But instead, it's like a dance routine from the 1940s, like bim, 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 like the music from Swap Meet.
Yeah, this is
it's a good bit.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's just the problem is there has to be a level of commitment, because I would say this to not only us, but I would have to say to the Download Nation as well. We'd have to get rid of a couple of segments on the show. Because I won't have time to read a book or do any of the prep that needs to be done, because we'll be in character at 3:30, 4 o'clock in a day game.
Coming, rolling in at 6:50.
Yeah, I'll be rolling in right when the show starts.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be dressed. We'd look good.
Yeah.
But we'd have to give up content, there's no doubt.
Yeah, I'm not sure about. Can't we just do it on the weekends?
We could. We just have to sell it as like, but then the tickets are more expensive on the weekend.
Yeah.
We're so close.
We'll come up with something.
We're so close to the new bit, the new bit craze, the new baseball character. Yeah, you've got a Ronnie Woo Woo with the Ronnie Woo. You got the Jerry Pritikin, the Bleacher Preacher. You got the Bleacher Bums. The guys dressed as Blues Brothers. But nobody dresses like a 1946, 1947 fan on a Sunday right after church. And then that could be us, and it's like a time travel. We've come here from the past. This is the future, right?
It has so many levels of enjoyment.
It really does, and the fans will love it. Players will learn to love it.
Yeah, we'll probably be asked to sing the seventh inning stretch during the World Series.
And think about
probably.
Think about all the Schwarber comes out with a fedora on and like throws it at us because he's just like, I know what you guys are doing.
Do you travel on one of those bikes?
Yeah, like
with
a double.
The big wheel and the
big wheel and the little wheel. Yeah. I think we have to figure out a way that we can arrive on streetcar. Because that would be more accurate to the time, right?
Well, we can. What about a trolley? It's sort of similar. You know, they look similar.
Lower to the ground trolley. Not one of these party buses. These illegal party buses that everybody's talking about. The bane of our ruining Chicago with these illegal party buses. Yeah, something. Yeah, how we get to the park. We definitely need that brass band that's always out in front of Wrigley playing. So they need to be there. We'd have to do something. 630's got a good one. That or DeLorean. Like, what if we show up in a DeLorean?
Yes. Yeah, well, Back to the Future.
The doors swing up and we get out in 1940s, Sunday's Best. Sunday Best to watch a baseball game. Are we ready?
You got the dialect down.
Yeah. And we could enter in, my favorite part is to have a seat at Wrigley Field that's way out in the back, you know, or way along the line or something like that, but actually come up to the concourse around home plate. So you walk all the way back there, you know, while the game's going on. And then we can do bits at that
People
point.
Start seeing
Say,
you.
Pete, look at this. Oh, beautiful day at Wrigley Field.
That kind of stuff. Because you're right. Because then, like Len and JD, I'm sure they'll see it. They'll put it on TV, talk about it.
Yeah, we'll get our own TV show. Comcast will give us like a 4 p.m. trivia. You know, they'll get rid of the cash one where they always give $1 for
the trivia.
But instead they'll have us do it now. We're like, who hit a home run in 1942?
Yes.
We'd love it. And we're on it. I feel like we've given away too much of it. We've brainstormed too much on the air. Now I feel like someone's going to do it and we're going to lose. We're not going to get credit.
Well, it's a trademark right now.
Trademark. Thanks, Rob. It's Never Have I Ever here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, 312-981-7200. We're going to play Never Have I Ever tonight. Of course, this is a fun party game that's usually played a lot dirtier. But we're not playing it dirty. We're playing it for real. And this started a couple weeks ago. Pete and I were having a conversation where I said, you know what? I've never in my life, never been golfing. All right. There you go. And then I believe who won the pizza, because I give away a pizza to the winner. The last time we played, about a week and a half ago, I want to say it was Mary, but she said she never had a car with automatic locks or windows.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine that? We had one that was, I've never been in a movie theater. Wow. It's crazy. I've never been scuba diving. Never have I ever been scuba diving. Never been snorkeling. So there you go. So, 312-981-7200. What's yours? The best tonight gets a pizza from Lou Malnati's. How about that, huh? Yeah. All right, I got a list of some stuff I've been noodling this week. All right. Never have I ever read The Grapes of Wrath. Have you read that book?
Nope.
There you go. Esmeralda, have you read that book?
I tried.
At least that counts.
I couldn't get into it. So, yeah. Halfway.
Yeah, I feel like that was one. I feel like at some point that was a book we were supposed to read in school, and I just kind of skipped it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Never have I ever gone past algebra in math studies.
You didn't have to take calculus or trig.
No. I, as the quintessential artist and also shyster, I was able to convince my counselors at school that Algebra 2 was enough for me. And I never moved on past Algebra 2. So when people talk about calculus or physics or any of the advanced mathematics, can't even say it. Mathematics. I'm lost. So that gives you an idea. I'd love to. I feel like if there were adult calculus courses, like if you could just pick it up, if you didn't have to go buy a calculator, I'd be down. I'd love to learn more about the fine arts of mathematics. But it just never happened. 630 says, never, ever have I driven through a place to get fast food. Wow. never, ever driven through a fast food drive-thru. That's, they really got to go out of the way for that, because that's there for you to, for your convenience.
Yeah. You probably prefer the dine-in.
Even if you prefer it, and I prefer the dine-in too, don't you at one point or another recognize, all right, I'll just get a hamburger to go.
You know what I don't like? I don't like anybody around me, near me, if I can't do it, driving while eating.
You can't do that?
I don't like when I'm just a passenger of somebody that's eating and driving. I don't like it.
See?
Makes me uncomfortable. Like, you know, unwrapping a burrito. You know, no. This is how the accidents happen.
Esmeralda, I figured out how to get rid of texting and driving. And that's just make all cars stick shift again.
Oh, that would be a lot of work. Although, you know, people would just
figure it out.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
See, but because you have to.
Right.
Isn't there a button you have to push to move it?
Well, it depends.
To hold down and then.
It depends. Like, if you could put a reverse, you know, you have to hold in some of the cars. But I just think, like, you're constantly having to adjust the gear of the car that you don't really have even time to get into the moment to go look at your phone, right? You text and drive. If you made all cars stick shift, you no more have no more texting and driving. But then people would try to do it because they'd use their knee or they whatever, and then they'd cause more trouble, and then it would get worse.
Never underestimate the public when they want to do something illegal.
Right.
We'll figure it out.
That's true. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Joanne. Joanne, never have you ever what?
Been to Great America.
You've never been to Great America?
Oh. Nope.
I have a funny story about that today. We had the field days. I was early talking in my son's school, and I volunteered, and I was in charge of the sponge volleyball station.
So
the idea that, you know, you go to you essentially dunk the sponge and you throw it across to someone on the other side and it gets them wet and they throw it back, and it's like it's a free for all. There's no objective to the game. It is a wild animal fourth grade free for all, right? And so we it's fun, right? It's the kids and all the kids want to do that station because they get wet. First time through, it got so wet because the ground was wet from the rain last night and everything. It just turned into mud puddles.
Oh, man.
And one of the kids kind of slipped, and he had to get his, you know, how are you going to change his shorts or whatever? So they shut it down. And so then the joke I told all the kids when they came over to line up, I go, has anyone here ever been to Great America? And they're all like, yeah. And I'm like, it's like when you go to Great America and the roller coaster is not in service. This one is broken. Go to the other one. Like, that was my bit all day long. So never been to Great America, Joanne. Well.
Yep.
You're not missing anything. It's a lot of lines.
That was always a bad day when you go there and, like the demon was not under construction or not in service or something. Yeah. Ugh, I hated that.
All right, we got a lot of great stuff coming through. 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. The best one tonight gets a pizza. Stay with us. You know, every time we do this segment, and I love it because it's another great opportunity for me to connect with you, the listener at home, and for us to have a conversation about who we are, but also at the same time win a free pizza. It's amazing to me. Every time we do this, Pete, there's a ton of response. And then I always say, oh, this is great. We should do it all the time. Then it always gets put on the back. Not this time. I've the 25 texts right here.
My wife just texted to say that she has never seen Twin Peaks.
Ooh.
All right. And it's coming. The reboot's coming out Sunday.
I just don't know where the time is in the day, but maybe. I think I told this story last week that we went to the. I had never seen Twin Peaks until I was in my 20s. I missed it the first time around. And my wife, she said, you got to see this show. So we went to the Dollar Video up on Ashland. And they had it, but they had it on VHS. And so we got the whole season. Like, you know, I rented like 20 VHS tapes in one sitting. Yeah. And we binge watched before that was a thing, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And I've never looked back. It's one of the best shows of all time.
She's got some work to do before the two-hour premiere this Sunday.
Is it this Sunday?
Yeah.
Ah!
Mm-hmm.
They didn't get back to. I really want to talk to Frost or Lynch or one of the guys. I love that show so much. It'd be great to get in their head a little bit. But they're like, meh. We got our money from Showtime. We don't need to do press on this. We did Entertainment Weekly. Anyway. All right, let's see what we got here. 312-981-7200. That's a good one. Never have I ever seen Twin Peaks. This one's a leader already, 630. Never have I ever had potato salad. Come on, man.
It's delicious.
It's delicious. And you could go mayonnaise-based or mustard-based. Ah, that's a great one. 773, never have I ever enjoyed any movie or TV show starring Jim Belushi. All right, now you're just being snarky.
He's at the Cubs game today.
Was he?
Yeah.
I like Jim Belushi's another guy I'd love to sit down and talk to. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. Yeah. Chicago guy, has been around. Interesting how he came up. Got through Saturday Night Live. Kind of what he does in L.A. with his all that. Anyway. 630, I've never have I ever found my name at a keychain kiosk. So interesting. I love that. I had that problem, too. Justin was not a popular name back in the 80s. So I had the same problem, Sven. 847 says, I never have I ever played a slot machine. Wow. Like, not even like a toy one where you just pull the kind of stuff that's like the tchotchkes at the airport. When you're in the Vegas airport, you're like, oh, I'm getting a slot machine. I love it. It spits out candy. You're not missing anything there. That's probably actually one of those that you never have. This 262, never have I ever let another car cut in front of me at a construction zone that I already know is 2 miles in advance that the right two lanes are closed. You're that guy. I'm not doing it. Nope. 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 Nope.
I get that way sometimes.
Yeah, and we all
a little
do that.
Irritable.
Nope. I'm not even going to look at him. I'm going to look straight ahead. I'm going to inch. Nope. 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 When I was in San Diego just recently, we went to SeaWorld. I realized I was following the GPS, and it's like, turn right on Sea Lane Drive. And they're like, in 2 miles, turn right on Sea Lane Drive. And then it's like, turn right. And I realized that the line of cars that are like stopped because there's construction, and it's like a mile, 2 miles back, is what I have to be in. But I missed it, and like I was already, you know, up there. So I had to do it.
Yeah,
I like turned in. Right. I just turned right in, and the guy who was driving the minivan, was just like, you are the worst.
Yeah,
and I was like, sorry.
Yeah, just look ahead.
Nothing you can do. I apologize. At least I go on the radio and apologize. Mea culpa. I apologize for that move. At least I have that. 815. I never have I ever tried Portillo's. Portillo's a great place. I don't think you're out of the norm to not have tried a certain chain of food.
Right? Yeah. Like, I have never been to Super Dog or Al's Beef.
What are you doing with your life? Both of those. What are you doing, Pete? Come on. We got to go. I'm going to take you out. Then we'll go and we'll watch the first. We'll get the VHS of Twin Peaks. 708 says, never have I ever been out of the country. That's a good one. You're missing out.
It's all right.
It's all right. Depends on where you go. Although every time I go out of the country, I get nervous and anxious. Then you get to the country, you're like, this is it? Come on, man. I can roll this place. I'm American. I'm from Chicago. Don't scare me. France. With your Amsterdam. With your canals. Good deal. 708 says, never have I ever smoked marijuana. 35-year-old white male. Again, not missing much. 630. That's the person saying that they don't do fast food drive through. They also don't do deli counter. It's like playing roulette with food contamination.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's roulette, but that's definitely a very conservative approach to fast food.
I prefer just to grab a potato salad that's in a carton or, you know, whatever, a tube or whatever you call it,
right,
you know,
right.
A container, as opposed to,
like, yeah.
As opposed to go, because I just, you know, like, I don't like taking the number.
Right.
And then I don't like people knowing my business. Like,
I don't
want to know people, like, people are also there that know that I want to pound a potato salad.
And you put the spoon in on the potato salad and you kind of see it react to the spoon, the first spoon touching it in maybe 2 days. Like, you know, so it's like it's got a little bit of film on it. Oh, no! Let's go to Donna. Donna, What's your never have I ever?
Never have I ever seen a Star Wars movie.
We get that one every time we do it. It's interesting. Like, you'd think that everybody in the world has seen that, but it's true. There are a lot of people that don't. Why haven't you? Why did you go out of your way to avoid 6 gazillion Star Wars movies?
It just, when they started, had no appeal to me, and now there's just too many to try and catch up.
You're like, if I even try right here, who's this? I don't even know who this guy is. Who's this Lando? Who's Lando?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And what do I care, right? It has nothing to do with my life.
Yeah, you're right. It's probably smart not to start. Although Jar Jar Binks is a dream. It's a pleasure. Jar Jar. All right, thanks, Donna.
You get that with a lot of TV shows and movies and things. Once, you know, a show that you've missed gets into like the third season or something, you're like, oh man, I'm never gonna catch up.
TV's the worst like that. Like, I've never have I ever watched 6 Feet Under.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I got it too, and I'm like, never have I ever watched Game of Thrones. And the problem, I say that I actually am a little bit off on that because I watched like the first 3 episodes and then I just never did anymore. And I'm like, I don't want to go back and start. And I'm going to have to start again because these all people have proper names and they're from families and one's a dragon and there's boobs. Like, I just like, I don't know what's happening. All right. 312-981-7200. Keep them coming. This is fun tonight. We will take a break. We'll get the update from Rob on the news and we'll come back and we'll play the second half of Never Have I Ever. We're giving away a pizza. Thanks, Rob. Playing Never Have I Ever for pizza tonight. 312-981-7200. Great stuff tonight. I'm always surprised at the response to this because it always is creative and thoughtful and people are bringing good stuff in. Esmeralda Leon, of course, I want to bring you in as well. You got a good Never Have I Ever? It can't be dirty.
No, okay.
I'm not playing that kind of game.
Darn! Well, skip me. No, I would say this is kind of lame because I could remedy this pretty easily. I have never been to a Bulls game.
Yay!
Never.
Oh. You've been to Blackhawks, right?
Yes.
So you've been in the building.
Yes, and that's only because of lovely WGN's courtesy.
That's a good one because, you should go. We should do a... Now you got me all thinking about it. Like, we should go to a Bulls game.
They look fun.
Yeah.
I'm not a big sports person, but I do like going.
There's a
to
ton
games.
Of t-shirt gun stuff.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Like I just like
t-shirt guns.
I like Benny the Bull.
Yeah. Benny the Bull is like there's like 5 Benny the Bulls. So there'll be one that's like acrobatic Benny the Bull that will like climb up the or fall from the rafters kind of thing or like dunk the ball. And then there's kind of like chunky Benny the Bull that like is the guy who comes out and dances with the cheerleaders. You
no.
ever notice that there's like 2 different Benny the Bulls?
Really?
Do they want you to think it's the same guy?
I'm not sure how it works. The original Benny the Bull that was like the Michael Jordan Benny the Bull, like that everybody knows.
Yeah.
That's the chunkier one that's like, hey, I'm kind of a doofus. And they changed it recently to like a more athletic Benny the Bull who can do flips off the trampoline and stuff like that.
I mean, they have to be.
Right.
Have you seen the other mascots?
Yeah, right. See, I think that's what it was.
He's got to...
The kids love the triple jump.
Yeah,
dunk.
He's got to really, he's got to do it.
Right. All right. That's a good one. There's actually another Never Have I Ever gentleman who's never been to a Bulls game, so maybe we could put something together there.
Me and him, we're going.
There you go. 708 says, I'm 58 years old and I've never worn wingtip shoes or boxer shorts. That's a combo. Strong combo. Like, it's the imagery alone where you're like, like, you'd think that he would be wearing the no pants, just the wingtips and the boxers. Maybe with, like, stirrup socks. Straight out of, like, a 70s. I just got home and watched The Price is Right. That kind of thing, you know. That's a good one. Very descriptive. 847 says, never, ever have I eaten lobster. Not because I have an allergy or anything, just never tried it.
Oh, man.
It's like a rich shrimp.
Kind of sweet.
Yeah. Richer shrimp. Right? What would you say without the shrimpy taste? It's like shrimp without the shrimp taste. I really nailed it with the description there.
Are Red Lobsters still around?
Oh, yeah.
I think they, yeah.
Yeah, there's one in Lincoln. I was just there a few weeks ago.
Oh, man, those cheddar biscuits.
Yeah.
To die for.
Yeah, we used to, like, when we were kids, that would be like when we go off to a fancy dinner, we were going to Red Lobster.
Yeah.
There's one in Lincolnwood, and then I think down south side somewhere.
Yes.
Maybe I think by Midway.
Yep, on Western. And there's one on, the one in Lincolnwood's the one that I've gone to. And they used to have a downtown one on Dearborn, and I only remember that because I got my car towed going to that one time.
It's a Chase Bank now.
Is it?
I was just very disappointed. Like,
we don't have any cheddar biscuits?
Let's do a Red Lobster Bulls game outing.
Man, we're getting ahead of it. We are the one-stop shop or the marketing team. We've got outreach. We're going to Red Lobster. We're dressing up at Cubs games. We're going to Bulls games. We got it. All right. That's a good one, though. The 773 says, never have I ever used a dishwasher. Yeah. I could see that. Like, if you live in the same place for a long time, you just don't have a dishwasher. Because when I growing up, I didn't have a dishwasher. Maybe it was the 80s.
Yeah.
But now, I don't know how you'd live without one.
We recently moved, and our old dishwasher was great. We moved into this new place, and this dishwasher is like state-of-the-art. You know, it's dynamite. It's like, you know, the best thing that you could buy. But I can't figure out how to work it. Yeah. And I looked, I got the instructions, and they were like, to operate the machine, there is an on button, press on, and then start. And that's all you have to do. But for some reason, nothing gets clean. I can't figure it out. I feel like such a dummy. I load in the dishes. Yeah, put the soap in there.
You press start.
Press start. Press on. It's the timer. There's a timer on it.
It goes, and then it goes, comes out, and it's still
it
dirty?
It comes out, and it's still dirty.
Uh-oh.
I'm like, what kind of shim-sham operation did we get sucked into here?
Like, how dirty?
It
looks like it hasn't been touched, or just kind of greasy
kinda,
stuff?
It looks like some of the, you know, utensils maybe are okay, but like my salad bowl perhaps is like still has salad caked
like
on.
Like straight up dirty or like European dirty where you're like, you know what? That's just sediment. It'll be fine.
I was going to say maybe the water's not hooked up.
Yeah.
No. Well, no, because it gets
wet.
Yeah, it's wet.
Interesting.
Yeah.
A mystery.
Because, I mean, yeah, like I... And then, like, every night I just redo it, hoping that, like, somehow the next day it's gonna automatically fix itself. I'm like, I get home at 1 or whatever. Yeah. I just run.
I wake up and ta-da.
Like, one more knife will be clean. I take that one knife out and then redo it.
Oh, it's this knife.
It's so frustrating.
Oh, this bowl's probably ruining the circulation. 630 says, never have I ever had a Coke with my name on it. Okay. 224, never have I ever seen The Godfather. I'm 58 years old. I had the same thing because I just saw The Godfather, but I saw it in that weird HBO way where they kind of remastered it and made a different storyline out of it. So I've actually never seen The Godfather either. 630 says, never have I ever been so dumb with my car GPS. Yesterday, somehow I got stuck in bicycle mode, and I was taking it into the city for about 40 minutes till I realized I was driving in the bicycle lane. That can't be true. It's like a stand-up bit. It's a good bit. 312 says, I've never been to an opium den. All right, well, you know what? I'm not going to lie to you. I don't think there's a lot of us that have. I'd like to experience that, like in a Robert De Niro, James Woods flick. What's an opium den? Is that just like people smoke opium? Is that what you do? So it's just like a den where people come in. There's like beads. Sharon Stone walks through. Hey, guys. Okay. All right. 847 says, I sent this one in a couple weeks ago, but I was too late in the show. Never have I ever slept with a Marine. Well, that's pretty specific. I couldn't tell you one way or the other if that's you're really missing out or not.
Well, you know that I assume that means that there's, you know, the Army, the Navy, Coast Guard, the Air Force.
Right.
Those are off the table.
Those are off
the table. I'm going to put my investigative hat on here.
You're, You're like a Sherlock Holmes of military branch. Never have I ever bought or owned a new car. 630. I fix and drive the junk my family and friends don't want anymore. You never get that new car smell. There's Larry saying that he's never been to a Bulls game. 773 Panders. Never have I ever won anything from the radio. All right. 630 says, never have I ever had a kid, a marriage, a home, or a car loan, or a full-blood sibling. Wow. Married myself and the sex has never been so good. That's what he says. Come on. It's after dark, right? It's 10:45. This guy nailing it with the jokes tonight. Ton of jokes. 773. This is a good one. Never have I ever gone to the movie theaters alone. It's on my to-do list. You should do it. 773, you should go to a kid's movie by yourself. That's always the weirdest. There was one time I think I had to do it for work. I think it was like Kubo or one of the ones that we were talking to people. And you go by yourself and right away you're just like, all right, this is the optics on this are not good.
When I used to work the mornings, I used to go to a lot of afternoon movies. And I saw Up in the afternoon with, you know, just by myself, a bunch of kids. And I got, you know, I'm very specific about my movies. I go and sit in the Roger Ebert seat. I get there early, get my popcorn, boom, I'm not moving. And it was pretty crowded. It was a small theater. It was pretty crowded. And a family moved like down my aisle and I had a separate, the family had to separate because I wasn't going to move my seat. So I had like a couple of kids on either side of me and a parent.
I'm not moving. This is my movie. This is Up. That's awesome, dude. That's awesome. That's awesome. You're like, nope, I work for a living. I'm finishing my coffee. 312-981-7200. All right, we'll come back. We'll wrap up still open. Never have I ever. And I will reward one of our great texters or callers with a free pizza from Lou Malnati. That's coming up. Stay with us. And I never hear on download 312-981-7200. Got some good stuff tonight, man. All right. 847 says, never have I ever used the 2 degrees that I have. Oh. You use them, though. You use them in life. You're a better, well-rounded person because you spent all that money on college. 847 says, never have I ever won a pizza on WGN. Okay. It's 708. Never have I ever paid money for the gym. I'm 50 years old. I'm a size 0. I eat what I want. And I've never had a weight problem. I want that pizza. A lot of texts about the dishwasher. Really getting on you, Pete, about figuring out what's wrong. 312 says, never been so disappointed. Never have I ever been so disappointed in my country. All right. The country's doing fine. 630 is from Sven, who had the key chain kiosk, and it's a very simple text. It just says, Sven is a Marine. First of all, referring yourself in third person is awesome. Sven would like to. All right. Never been to a Blackhawks game, says 815. Six-three-oh's mad that I said that it sounded like a joke. I forgot which one it was. I think it was the bike.
Bike?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now they're mad saying, apparently my whole life is a joke to you. All right. Come on. Never have I ever had a White Castle hamburger. 630.
Oh, man.
Never have I ever voted for a candidate that has won the election. Wow. Because there's been different parties. You're just switching over. You're an independent in the way that you're like, I think I'm going to go to caucus. And then they switch up and they're like, I think George H.W. Bush is doing a good job. Like, you really have to, like, you yeah, change it up,
going
right?
back and forth. You're
going back and forth. I don't know. This Al Gore guy. John McCain, he's straight from the, shoots on the hip. 773, never have I ever eaten peanut butter.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
An allergic thing?
Maybe. Six three L's is I don't know what 7 6 3 L's is. This Sven? I don't know sure if it is. No, but 6 3 L's like not to sound overconfident. I don't know which one. I'm gonna try to figure it out. But I've already won a contest on WGN a couple weeks ago. So give my pizza to somebody else. Like I haven't even chosen yet. That's great. Let's see who that is. I just want to see which one it is because I think I love the confidence. Potato salad, strong.
Yeah, it was a good one.
That's one that's on my list. You yeah. are not to be overconfident, you know. It's good. Never have I ever dove off the high dive. Like all the way up on the pool.
On the pool?
Yeah. Let's go to Mary. Mary, what's your never have I ever?
I have never went on a vacation by myself. I'm 74.
I might be in that same category. Because I don't know when I would have gone on vacation by myself. Because vacation's a weird one because there are times I've traveled by myself.
No, I've never done anything like that by myself.
So, like, even travel for business or to visit family or anything like that, okay. So that is kind of a never have I ever because I've traveled a lot by myself.
No, I haven't. I'm too chicken.
You're too chicken?
Yes.
What's scaring, like the plane, the anxiety of like doing the whole thing?
Oh, I don't like planes, so I won't go in an airplane. And I don't like water because I can't swim. So I'm just stuck here.
No, there's a lot of other options. Go to Las Vegas. There's no water there.
Well, I'd love to go there.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. You know, I'd say, you know, my mother-in-law, she didn't do much traveling at all, and we went to Las Vegas not too long ago, and she really liked it. Like, there's something about it. There's a connection to it. It's got a little bit of old and a new. It's expensive. And you get to see a bunch of guys wearing really dumb clothes. It's a lot of guys with really dumb fashion, like the embroidery on the shirts, you know, and things like that. So you got
they all do that now. Everywhere.
Yeah, right. But you get a lot of it in Las Vegas.
What about like Branson or Dollywood, you know, like take the train or and so you don't have to deal with planes.
Yeah. 773 says, I've never eaten lobster, shrimp, bacon, pork, or ham. Or rid... 773. I've never eaten lobster, shrimp, bacon, pork, or ham, or ever ridden in a limo. That's the sentence.
Man, you know, really ride that limo, and you're going to begin to you get tons of pork and bacon in there.
Yeah, right. That's all that's. I hate to be the one to tell you, but if you go in there, it's just like ham hocks, and like there's sizzling bacon in the back. That's why people take limos. 312, never had a manicure.
Nor have I.
Yeah, I don't think I had a pedicure one time, which was weird.
Yeah, I don't like people touching my digits.
Yeah, it wasn't great. And then never have I ever been grateful for my college degree. Oh, that's okay. There you go. All right, we got a lot of good stuff. All right, we're going to give away a Lou Malnati's gift certificate pizza. We'll do that. Of course, Lou Malnati's great place. You can go find it online, loumalnati's.org, all that. Well, we'll give away a pizza. And tonight, I'm going to give the pizza away to 630 to Sven. Sven, who said, I never found my name at a keychain kiosk. I've always looked, and every single one I walk by, forever disappointed. Even middle name. Sven Kirsten. And the reason I'm giving it to Sven is that when the 847 said, never have I slept with a Marine, Sven wrote back, 630 said, Sven's a Marine in third person. So you know what? That's worth the pizza. That's good stuff, man. Sven, you get the pizza. Thanks for playing, you guys. Never have I ever. Great one tonight. We're going to keep it in rotation. I love it. And thank you, everybody, for playing along. It's a lot of fun to get to know what you guys haven't done and what we haven't done here in studio. We'll do it again next week. All right, coming up, Patty Vasquez. That's going to do it tonight for The Download. Patty Vasquez up next. Tomorrow night, Jean-Michel Jarre, considered to be the father of electronic EDM music, French composer, put out his first record in 1977. Really, really interesting guy. He's going to be at the Auditorium Theater on Monday.
Oh, I love the Auditorium Theater. I got to tell you, Justin, it's fantastic over there.
Let's go. It's always good to see a good show there. They don't use microphones.
Great dames over there, I'm telling you.
We got a winner, man. We're going to do a video. We're going to win a local Emmy for this one. I don't know if there's a category for...
Todd's like, why did I uncork these three knuckleheads?
Four knuckleheads. Esmeralda's in, too.
Oh, is Esmeralda in, too? Yeah, good. All right. Four knuckleheads, then.
And we're the idea, let's do a download, we can even do a show, but let's do a night where we get a rooftop, and then everybody who comes to the party has to dress up like the 40s, like this. We can even give them costumes.
Oh, man.
And then when we all sit in the rooftop and it's packed, that'll be a huge thing. They'll be like, you'll do an ESPN Sunday night game. And they'll be like, take a look at the rooftops over here. That's a little, and we'll get on the broadcast.
Sure.
I'm just thinking ahead. Marketing brain.
I'm in.